Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Glorified, romanticized, mythologized, and in some circles condemned, bullfighting continues to be a Spanish cultural institution with a long and interesting history. In a moment, we'll explore that history with historian Adrian Schubert. But before we do that, let's look at an important event that occurred this week in history. Those of you who attended university commencement exercises this year no doubt noticed that a multitude of women now graduate from law school. But it was not until this week in 1870 that the first woman, Ada H. Kepley, graduated from an American law school. Born in Somerset, Ohio, Ada moved with her parents to Effingham, Illinois, where she met a lawyer and her future husband, Henry Kepley, whom she married in 1867. With her husband's encouragement, she began studying law at Union College of Law in Chicago in 1869. She received her degree the next year, but in Illinois law, denied women admission to the state bar. She devoted herself to the causes of women's rights and temperance, becoming a leader of the Prohibition Party and the Women's Christian Temperance Union. In spite of her accomplishments in these areas, Kepley never practiced law and spent her last years lonely and poor. After her husband died in 1906, Kepley turned to writing to make a living, but made little money. She died in 1925 after being admitted to the hospital as a charity case. Her contributions to today's woman lawyers all but forgotten. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, for over two centuries, archaeologists have insisted that Miami was the only English settlement in Florida prior to the Revolutionary War. In a recent dig in Jupiter, Florida, however, they discovered fragments of a tobacco pipe and plaster that suggest there may have been a colonial English settlement there as well. Researchers believe that the tobacco pipe was of a type made only in England from 1745 to 1790, and that the site might be the long-lost Grenville Plantation, referred to in the historical record, but never located. Researchers are seeking to verify the identity of the colony and to answer the question of what led to its mysterious disappearance. After nearly a century of deconstruction by contemporary scientists, the revolutionary ideas of psychologist Sigmund Freud have come under renewed criticism. While criticism of Freud is nothing new, scientists are now attacking him specifically for his faulty science, his notion that dreams are the royal road to comprehending the unconscious state, for example, is being challenged by studies of rapid eye movement sleep. Nevertheless, Freud's proponents continue to defend him for being the scientist coming closest to explaining the intricacies of human motivation and as the most analyzed psychoanalyst in history. You're listening to Talking History. The ring is freshly raked, the matadors take their bows, and brass bands play the pasodoble, after which the bullfight begins. Bullfighting is an important part of Spanish history, but has it changed to survive in the modern world? So argues our guest this week, Adrian Schubert, in his conversation with Talking History's Eileen Dugan.
The Spanish bullfight is a tradition that today provokes passionate debate. On the one hand, many see it as a spectacular expression of Spanish culture. On the other hand, many decry it as nothing short of animal abuse. Is this criticism new? What is the place of the bullfight in traditional Spanish culture? With us today to discuss the origins of bullfighting is Dr. Adrian Schubert, professor of history at York University in Toronto. Dr. Schubert is the author of a series of books and articles in Spanish history, including the recent monograph, Death and Money in the Afternoon, A History of the Spanish Bullfight. Welcome, Dr. Schubert.
Hello, hi.
Just how old is the sport of bullfighting?
Well, the bullfight that we know today basically emerged at the end of the 17th, beginning of the 18th centuries. It emerged out of much older activities, basically two. One was an aristocratic activity, which we could see as a kind of a form of jousting when nobles fought bulls on horseback. This was something that was common in the Middle Ages. And then there was a popular form of doing things with bulls as part of a local village fiesta, which goes back, really no one knows how far. But the bullfight we know, as I said, is really a late 17th, early 18th century creation.
And when did they start fighting on foot?
Well, that is really when the bullfight changed from something which where the central figure was someone mounted on a horse. In the aristocratic version, that person had been assisted by people on foot, but the sort of the central actor in the bullfight was the man mounted on horseback. By the 18th century, that switched, and the central figure is the matador on foot that we know today.
And why did bullfighting come to flourish in Spain in particular? I mean, is this a cultural phenomenon?
Well, if you mean by that, if there's some kind of cultural predilection among Spaniards towards bullfighting, I think I'd answer no. I think we need to answer the question, to look at a slightly broader context. Well, today we associate the bullfight with Spain and sort of Latin America, or some Latin American countries. Historically, bull events existed in a number of other countries where they have subsequently disappeared, so that there is an indigenous tradition of bullfighting of a different sort in France, and in England there was a practice of running bulls, sort of similar to what they do in Pamplona, which existed into the 19th century and was only suppressed in the 1830s with the emergence of animal rights and animal protection societies in England. But there were parts of the United States where which earlier had been under Spanish and then Mexican rule, where there was bullfighting, which was then prohibited when these areas came under U.S. rule. So I think one thing we need to keep in mind is that if bullfights or certain kinds of bull events don't exist in some places, it's not because they were never there or there is some antipathy, but rather for historically specific reasons, they were suppressed in those places.
And yet even in Spain from the 18th, 19th century, we are hearing about protests within Spain towards the bullfight. How did that come about?
Well, yes, there has always been in Spain some element of protest against the bullfight. And you mentioned the 17th, 18th century. Wanting to go back even further, in the 16th century, the Pope, can't remember right now which one, issued a bull of excommunication against anyone involved in bullfighting. And there was a Catholic argument, part of which was that people who fought bulls exposed themselves to getting killed, and it was akin to suicide. Then in the 18th century, there was an argument which was common amongst the enlightened intellectual elite in Spain, along the lines of that the bullfight was bad for the economy, that it was barbaric, it was not European, and that it should be banned. And indeed, there was a brief period of time in which the bullfight was banned. It was banned by King Charles IV in 1805.
And yet the bullfight did come to be supported by cities. How is that so?
Well, as I said, the opposition that I've mentioned so far, and then the opposition which continued into the 19th century, was, I think, really a minority affair. And indeed, I think the opposition to the bullfight in Spain today is a minority affair. One of the reasons that people supported the bullfight, you mentioned specifically cities, was that in the 18th century, bullfights were very frequently used as a kind of fundraising mechanism by all sorts of institutions, municipal governments. For example, if a city needed to repair its roads or build or its water delivery system, and they instead of raising taxes, they would ask permission of the crown to hold a number of bullfights, and use the profits to carry out this, you know, these activities. So one could see that for cities and also for religious institutions and other institutions, it was kind of like the lottery is for governments today. You know, it's a way of raising money for public purposes without actually reverting to taxation.
And how complex is the business aspect of bullfighting?
Well, it is a complex business. I mean, first of all, it is a business, and one of the, if not the main point I try to get across in my book, is that the bullfight is, and from its beginnings in the 18th century, has always been a business. And this is something which some of the people, particularly who have the more romantic view of the thing, either forget or never knew in the first place. And it is a pretty complex business. Obviously, there are the bullfighters. There are the people who raise bulls and sell them. There are people who raise horses and sell them. There are the promoters. In terms of its structure, business structure, bullfighting probably more resembles boxing than professional sports leagues. There are no leagues or league structures, but rather individual promoters in different cities who control the local bull ring and who organize the bullfights. And so they buy the bulls, hire the bullfighters, and take care of all the other arrangements. Also, there from very early on, there were agents. Bullfighters had agents who would negotiate their contracts for them and take care of their business affairs. And then there were large numbers of auxiliary people who work in the bull ring, taking tickets, ushers, selling refreshments, selling programs, that sort of thing.
And how famous did the breeders of the bulls become?
The breeders? Some breeders became very famous. I mean, if their bulls gained a reputation for being particularly valiant, then their fame rose, and the prices that they could demand for their bulls rose. The one, I suppose, the ranch or breeder that was famous for the longest time was one called Miura. Basically, in the late 19th century and well into the 20th, their bulls had the reputation of being the fiercest and the toughest to fight, and the ones that had sort of killed the largest number of bullfighters.
Now, you've already made a comparison between bullfighting and boxing in this organization, and you make the point, very interesting point in your book, about how bullfighting was one of the first examples of commercialized mass leisure and spectator sports. How would you explain that?
If we think of a range of commercialized forms of commercialized leisure which are common in our societies today, obviously professional sports is, you know, probably at the very top of the list. I mean, there are all kinds of other things like motion pictures and concerts. It's an open question whether one would actually call bullfighting a sport, and I, on balance, prefer not to, but I think one can certainly compare it to them for these purposes. The professional sports we're familiar with today, professional baseball, football, ice hockey, soccer in Europe, really, emerged and became important in the last quarter of the 19th century, the 1870s on, in all of those cases. Bullfighting was fully established as a significant form of commercialized mass leisure at least a century before that. So that, you know, if you look at the main features of it, the idea of, for example, building a special building, a stadium, a bull ring, where this would take place, the bull ring was a very unusual, novel structure. There had been no such kind of building in Europe since the time of the Romans. Buildings built specifically to house this activity. Now, of course, any city with pretensions to being significant has a baseball stadium, a football stadium. But in the 19th century, having something like that, having a bull ring, just didn't exist outside, or equivalent to a bull ring, didn't exist outside of Spain.
And in a similar vein as well, how were the matadors among the first superstars?
Well, very quickly, the leading bullfighters became both great popular heroes and idols, and also earn huge amounts of money. It's kind of one of the problems I had in doing this is because, you know, bullfighters didn't sign season-long contracts. They signed, you know, the contracts with specific promoters for individual fights. It's difficult to actually figure out how much bullfighters earn. So I actually did manage to track down some of their contracts in notarial archives and did some estimates. But for example, in the, I can give you an example from the 18th century. In the 1770s, a man who would, at that time was at the beginning of his career, later would become a major star, fought for 15 days in Madrid. And in those 15 days, his earnings were equal to the average annual income of all the city's lawyers. So, you know, in 2 weeks, he had earned an amount of money which would have put him solidly in, you know, to use our terms, the middle or upper middle class. If we go into the 19th century, towards the end of the century, when bullfighters' incomes had gone up considerably, the top bullfighters earned in one afternoon more than a high school teacher did in a year, or more than the president of the Supreme Court did in 2 months. And just to give you one more example and come into the 20th century and to compare it to an American example, through the 1920s, Babe Ruth was the highest paid athlete and professional athlete in the United States, was here the highest paid baseball player ever. His peak salary was $80,000 in 1 year. Well, the sort of his contemporary in bullfighting was a man by the name of Juan Belmonte, and in 1924, Belmonte got a contract to appear in Lima, Peru, and this was during the Spanish off season. And for 7 bullfights in Lima, he was paid $63,000, and he probably his annual salary in Spain would have been, you know, many times that.
Wow. Now, so far we've been talking about the men in bullfighting, but what role have women had in bullfighting?
Well, one of the things that surprised me when I did my research was that basically almost from the very beginning of the modern bullfight, certainly the late 18th century, there have always been some women matadors. They haven't been very many. They've been, by and large, marginal figures. They haven't been major stars. And almost always they've been looked down upon by both their fellow matadors and sort of the educated bullfighting public. But the point remains that they've always been there. There was one exception. There was a brief period between 1908 and 1931 when the bullfight was banned, that women were prohibited from participating in the bullfight. But other than that, they've always been there. So most people think that the presence of women in the bullfight is a very recent phenomenon. That is not, in fact, the case.
We only have a moment remaining, but in your opinion, what is the future of bullfighting, especially in the face of what is now increasingly vocal animal rights groups?
Well, I think in a curious kind of way, I'd say that the bullfighting has a very, very bright future. In the last 10 or 15 years or so, its popularity has recovered tremendously. There was a period sort of in the 60s and 70s and early 80s at the end of the Franco regime and after the Franco regime when bullfighting became lost popularity in Spain, in part because the regime had tried to manipulate it for political purposes, also because I think many Spaniards felt, you know, that they wanted to be real Europeans and that this was getting in the way of them being real Europeans. But what seems to have happened in the last 15 years or so, as Spain has become wealthier and more like everywhere else in Europe, more and more Spaniards are sort of turning to the bullfight as one of the few remaining symbols of their own culture. You know, that's something that's specifically Spanish as opposed to more, you know, European or, you know, American or global. Social groups within Spain, sort of intellectuals who historically have been, you know, either neutral or indeed against the bullfight, now find it fashionable. The number of books written about the bullfight, for example, has increased significantly in the last few years. And the odd time when someone in the European Parliament, usually from Britain, introduces a bill to prohibit the bullfight, this provokes great outrage in Spain. So I think the dialectic between globalization and local cultures, many Spaniards are seeing the bullfight as one of the few remaining local things as the rest of their culture becomes more like everywhere else.
Right. Thank you, Dr. Schubert.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking with Dr. Adrian Schubert, professor of history at York University, and author of the recent book, Death and Money in the Afternoon, The History of the Spanish Bullfight.
Recently, a group of American companies, including Ford, General Motors, Exxon, and Kodak, acknowledged that they had factories in Germany that benefited from Nazi slave labor. The acknowledgement raises the specter of American as well as European ties to the abuses of German anti-Semitism. But for historians, this is not a new question. As Stephen Allen reports, the United States has a history of anti-Semitism. Allen is an independent scholar living in St. Joseph, Michigan.
The United States is a young country, and it would seem to be free of many of the ghosts of history that haunt older nations. One such ghost is anti-Semitism, and with increasing frequency these days, Europeans are being confronted with the anti-Semitism of their past. Austria became something of a pariah state because of the formation of a governing coalition, including a party that many view as sympathetic to Nazi ideals. Switzerland has been forced to account for the way Swiss banks handled gold seized from Jews by the Nazis. Pope John Paul II made a public apology for the past anti-Semitism of the Roman Catholic Church, visited the Holocaust Memorial in Jerusalem during his trip to the Holy Land, and was still criticized for not doing enough. But while other nations and groups have confronted their past anti-Semitism, the United States has remained comparatively unaffected. A handful of American companies have admitted some responsibility for the use of Jews as slave laborers during the 1930s and 40s, but on the whole, they've been able to shift the blame to their foreign subsidiaries. Unlike the Roman Catholic Church, the United States does not have leaders who place a high priority on confronting past moral failures. And because the United States fought against the Nazis in World War II, it has not been forced to confront historical anti-Semitism in the same way that Germany and Austria have. We were on the side of right and justice, so why should we have anything to feel sorry about? But the United States has its own history of anti-Semitism. As Adolf Hitler was rising to power in Germany, the United States was producing its own anti-Semitic demagogues. One of the most popular of these was Father Charles Coughlin, a Roman Catholic priest whose radio programs attracted an estimated 40 million listeners. Although he did not start out as an anti-Semitic broadcaster, by the late 1930s he was speaking out in support of the Nazis and blaming Jews for a host of political and economic troubles. American anti-Semitism may in fact have had some influence on events in Germany. In 1920, Henry Ford's newspaper, The Dearborn Independent, carried a series of articles outlining a malignant and completely fictional Jewish world conspiracy. Ford later had these articles reprinted in a book called The International Jew, The World's Foremost Problem. This book was translated into German and was distributed by the Nazis. Hitler at one point even called Ford, quote, my inspiration, end quote. This American anti-Semitism is little known these days. Anti-Semitism in general seems to be a relic of the past, something that no longer causes problems in the United States. But this is far from the case. The year 1999 alone saw the shooting spree of white supremacist Benjamin Smith, during which he targeted a Jewish neighborhood near Chicago, an attack on a Jewish daycare center in California, and the firebombing of several synagogues. And there are more subtle forms of anti-Semitism, such as when political or religious leaders refer to the United States as a Christian nation. Clearly, the United States needs to do something about its native anti-Semitism. Germany, Austria, the Roman Catholic Church, to some extent all of these are facing up to their past. So should we.
You've been listening to Stephen A. Allen, whose op-ed comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. This is Talking History. If you're traveling through Kentucky this summer, on vacation or business, you might take some time to visit the lovely spot from which one of the most popular songs in American history emanated. Here to tell you all about that site is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Step into the antebellum South at my old Kentucky home state park in Bardstown, Kentucky. It was once the estate of Judge John Rowan, who was also a congressman, senator, and U.S. commissioner to Mexico. Rowan's cousin, Stephen Foster, visited the 19th century mansion and wrote the famous song, My Old Kentucky Home. Each summer, the park presents Stephen Foster, the musical, in its outdoor amphitheater. For information about the musical, you can visit the website, stephenfoster.com, and if you want more information about the park and the special Christmas candlelight tours in November and December, contact My Old Kentucky Home State Park.
And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions. 100 years after its publication, that very American fantasy, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, is being celebrated by the Library of Congress. Among the principal characters in L. Frank Baum's fairy tale are a scarecrow from a Midwestern cornfield and a tin woodsman whose mechanisms recall Yankee traditional ingenuity. Hero Dorothy insists on how much she loves her Kansas home and wants to get back to it. And the wizard himself, like Talking History, hails from Omaha. What more can we say? Refresh your memory about all of this and learn more at Oz, the exhibition, which runs through September 23rd at the Library of Congress. And in preparation for next week's show marking Independence Day, we call to your attention 6 hours of programming on the History Channel devoted to the American Revolution. On Monday, July 3rd, the History Channel will air a three-part series that examines the war from its start to finish, including an examination of its causes, military history, and conclusion. Be sure to check your local listings for exact showtimes. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we will mark Independence Day by taking a look at the Declaration of Independence. Until then, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.